Okay, so actually what I'll be talking about is only the cosmic sources of ultra-high energy neutrinos, by which I mean GeV and above. I will not address MeV neutrinos or solar neutrinos or the kind of neutrinos that are produced in the stellar collapses, except peripherally, although it's a very important topic. But it's not my area of expertise, and actually it's the ultra-high energy portion that I was asked to address. Now, the you know, when you start talking about TV neutrinos and higher up to GZK, of course, there are a number of very interesting new physics possibilities beyond the standard model that arise. But in order to motivate the need for such new physics, really you first have to take stock of the more, quote, conventional astrophysical ways of producing that kind of high energy particles, neutrinos, also cosmic rays and others. And here is a list of the prime suspects for producing ultra-high energy neutrinos: gamma ray bursts, and you know, they're especially those that are associated with collapse of massive stars, some relationship to supernova, and first generation of stars, so-called population 3. AGNs for a long time, active galactic nuclei, particularly those that have powerful jets with high Lorentz factors called blazars or radio loud quasars, have been implicated for a long time in producing these type of radiation. More recently, microquasars. Microquasars are a kind of galactic source. They're not big giant galaxies, but they're more stellar mass objects related to accreting neutron stars and accreting black holes. So they're objects of a few solar masses, but they have jets, and they look like quasars in miniature. So they're more local. And then supernova remnants, of course, they have shocks moving out, and you can do Fermi acceleration, and then obviously you can produce, you know, accelerate particles and produce perhaps photohadronic processes, you know, photomeson interactions, etc. Neutron stars and black holes, well, certainly pulsars are accelerate particles. They should also accelerate protons, and you know, it's possible that one can produce neutrinos there. Magnetars are a kind of neutron star, a kind of pulsar with a very strong, super strong magnetic field, whereas the normal pulsars have 10 to the 12 Gauss fields, magnetars have 10 to the 15 Gauss fields, and so they're in a sense, you know, they can produce stronger magnetic fields, stronger electric fields, and therefore maybe accelerate to higher energies. Gamma ray bursts are distributed isotropically over the sky, and they occurred about one a day out to our cosmological redshifts, Z's of a few. There are two classes. About one third of them are so-called short bursts. Gamma ray emission lasts less than a few seconds. Two-thirds are long bursts, longer than 2 seconds. It is suspected that the short ones are related to neutron star mergers, or perhaps neutron star black hole mergers, but it's not proven. It's a strong suspicion. There is much better evidence for the long bursts being associated with massive stellar collapses and perhaps with supernova. There is a lot of data on the second class. Now, as far as AGNs and the related objects, there have been observations at GeV energies with EGRIT and previous missions, and as much as almost 70, more than 70 AGNs have been found, of which a lot are blazars. Blazars are a particular type of very energetic jet sources where the jet is pointing almost at the observer. Also some other sources like pulsars and supernova remnants, of course solar flares as well, and plus a bunch of unidentified sources. Of these, some have been observed also at TV energies with ground Aircherenkov telescopes. And among these are a bunch of blazars, some of which have been seen on GEV and some not. Some are somewhat strange objects. It's a radio blazar here. This is actually a star-forming galaxy, which is not an active galaxy per se, but it may have galactic-type sources producing TV emission. Opa, sorry, backspace. Then there are supernova remnant-type sources and pulsars that have also been identified at TV with Aircherenkov telescopes, and there is a number of others that really we don't know what they are. So these are all, once you make TV photons, you suspect that you either have synchrotron inverse Compton type of leptonic processes, and or you have maybe acceleration of protons as well, and the protons then can do photomeson and produce neutrinos. Now, the typical scenario for gamma ray bursts is something that resembles a bit an AGN. You have either a merger of two neutron stars or a compact binary, which leads to after the stars disrupt, leads to a central black hole. The central core exceeds the Chandrasekhar mass. The debris orbits around it and accretes on a sort of very transient type of phenomenon, and that powers a jet. And the jet then is suspected to be relativistic, and eventually that leads to gamma rays, as I'll show a bit later. You get the same scenario, actually, if you have the collapse of a fast-rotating massive star, let's say 20 or 30 solar masses, because the central collapsing core exceeds the Chandrasekhar mass, so you get, again, a black hole. And because of the fast rotation, there is the centrifugal axis has lower density, so a jet is usually able to get through there. So you get, again, the same type of basic black hole and jet system. Now, when you look at the amount of energy that's liberated there in such a small region of space, it turns out that it's like a fireball. It's extremely compact. The energy density is extremely high. You will make a lot of electron-positron pairs and gamma rays, and the pressure will be huge, so it will expand. And in fact, the expansion, you can prove, has to be highly relativistic, because you observe up to 10 GeV gamma rays, and those gamma rays would be degraded by just two photons going into pairs, unless the two photons are moving almost parallel to each other. So since the cross-section is angle-dependent, you get then a lower limit on the Bok-Lorentz factor, which is of the order of 100. So it's a phenomenological, it's practically an observational constraint that tells you the outflow has to be highly relativistic. Now, these Lorentz factors are significantly higher by factors of 3 to 5 from those that are measured in AGNs. So these, in a sense, are, again, mini AGNs. And so the scenario is that, you know, in both of those cases, you get a rotating black hole, a debris torus, which is at nuclear densities. It's like neutron star densities, 10 to the 15 grams per cubic centimeter nuclear densities. And matter accretes, but this matter is sort of, you know, it's chaotic. So there are chaotic motions lead to a dynamo mechanism that boosts the field up. And you probably have very strong fields, which could get up to magnetar values, 10 to the 15 Gauss or so. But it's not needed to have those fields. Neutrino-antineutrino annihilation will produce enough lepton pairs that you can actually power a fireball. There is some discussion as to whether the jet from the neutrino-antineutrino annihilation produces enough energy. If not, then you have to rely on the magnetic fields, you know, providing the entropy of the jet. It's probably a combination of both. Numerical simulations, albeit just pure hydro, no MHD, have been made simulating the deposition of energy in the lower portions of a star. to see the development of a jet and to see whether one can get Lorentz factors of, you know, order 100. And now finally, after a while, it's getting to the point where the numerical simulations do show that you can reproduce that. It's a little bit dependent on initial conditions and how you put it. But, you know, with plausible assumptions, you can simulate such relativistic jets, and you can show that they actually get through the star. They manage to escape. So, you know, you can talk plausibly of a lot of, you know, at energy deposition comparable to a gamma ray burst energy being, you know, pumped in here, and it actually results in a jet which gets out of the star, and then it does its thing out there. All right. Now the thing is, when such a jet gets out, first it can have, you know, so it gets into a so-called optically thin region where the density is low. And so, you know, it's not a high opacity. And fast portions of the jet can catch up with slower portions. You know, if the output is time dependent, you can have these internal shocks, which then will accelerate particles and produce radiation. And eventually, the whole thing will run into external material, and then it will get decelerated. So it's thought that that bit there, the internal shocks produce the gamma rays, and the external shocks produce the afterglow, which decreases as the shock decelerates. So if you plot the Lorentz factor of the outflow, initially inside the star, it grows linearly, then it saturates when you have and its rest frame has become non-relativistic. Then internal shocks produce gamma rays that gets rid of some of the bulk kinetic energy, and then you run into the external medium, and as you accumulate more and more matter, the Lorentz factor drops as a power law, and you produce, you know, X-rays, optical, radio. As the thing gets slower, the Doppler boost is lower, and so the radiation characteristic energy gets lower in time. So it's a fading afterglow, and this was actually a prediction of these gamma ray burst shock model, which was borne out by observations of the afterglows with satellites somewhat later. The spectra are non-thermal in the optically thin region, and so they consist of a synchrotron component and an inverse Compton component. It's non-thermal because you have accelerated electrons and positrons to a power law by bouncing back and forth on these shocks, Fermi acceleration. And then as the Lorentz factor fades, these non-thermal power law shifts to lower energies, and you can predict the power law decay of the radiation. Now this is just the lepton component. Protons presumably also get accelerated, and they can do separate other things. Now, in the fireball, whether it's neutron star mergers or whether it's a collapse of a massive star, you'll have certainly a good admixture of neutrons as well. And initially, within the star or in the lower part of the jet, you'll have the neutrons and the protons coupled by elastic nuclear scattering. The radiation pressure acts on the protons, it doesn't act on the neutrons, but the neutrons go along for the ride because they're coupled by elastic scattering. But at some point, there is, you know, they start lagging, and at some point the lag of the neutrons relative to the protons is enough that the relative velocity approaches the speed of light, and at that point the collisions become inelastic, and then you produce pions and neutrinos, and that will produce a neutrino signal which is of the order of 5 to 10 GeV. The pionots will produce gamma rays, which will be again 1 to 10 GeV and maybe detectable with GLAST. The neutrinos at 5 to 10 GeV at a redshift of 1 would produce a decent rate integrated over all sources of about 7 per year, except that a detector like IceCube would have to be instrumented in a special way. The threshold of IceCube is more like 0.1 TeV or so, and so to get such a low threshold, you would have to put a much higher density of phototubes. So you'd have to do a special instrumentation. So it's interesting, but these may be difficult to detect with something like IceCube, unless it's a very nearby source, perhaps. Now, as I was mentioning, in the same shocks that accelerate electrons and produce gamma rays should accelerate protons, and the protons that are accelerated to a power law should interact with the gamma rays themselves. Both of them are in the co-moving frame of the jet, and so the, you know, the using the delta resonance condition above that, you get these photomeson neutrinos. And so the characteristic energy is about a few hundred TeV, and the spectrum is a spectrum with a broken power law shape like these, which is what you expect from the internal shock protons, accelerated protons. Now, after the jet has run into the external medium and starts to decelerate, as in a supernova remnant, there is a blast wave moving into the external medium, and there is a reverse shock moving into the ejecta itself. And these reverse shock is subrelativistic, whereas the forward shock produces gamma rays and X-rays, the reverse shock produces optical UV. And so it's a second set of softer photons with which the protons can interact, and that produces these so-called afterglow neutrinos, which are important at higher energies. And I've marked there the cosmic ray bound that you would get if the high energy cosmic rays observed are extragalactic, and they all are able to produce, you know, to convert a similar amount of their energy into neutrinos. Only sources which are opaque to protons could exceed that cosmic ray bound, the WB limit marked there. Those are somewhat outdated models of AGN jets. After it was realized that this was a problem, you know, people realized that they were too optimistic in these jet models. So those three that violated are earlier. They're, you know, from 97 and so on. They're model predictions that were actually put into trouble by these, the realization that there was such a cosmic ray bound. So nowadays, these, you know, those models have been revised to accommodate the constraints. Now, all right, this is what I was mentioning here, that the reverse shock of the afterglow will produce higher energy neutrinos. So I won't spend much time on these since I want to get on. Now, in gamma ray bursts, you know, there is another interesting possibility, and that is that the jet, as it's making its way, okay, in the long bursts, which are supposed to be associated with massive stellar collapses, the jet has to spend some time just working its way out of the star. And while it's inside the star, it actually is able to undergo internal shocks again and accelerate protons inside the star, and, you know, interact with the thermal photons in the jet cavity, as well as the photons that it produces by synchrotron or whatever there. So it can produce neutrinos. And then there is a possibility that all that collides with these nice beam dump here, which is the envelope of the star. So actually, you can produce neutrinos even though everything else may be swallowed up. If the jet doesn't make it out, you'll still see the neutrinos. So the neutrinos, in a sense, you can get the precursor neutrino signal lasting, you know, from tens to hundreds of seconds before the burst, the gamma ray burst, if the jet actually does make it out and do a gamma ray burst out there. Plus, if the jets don't make it out because the star is too big, too massive, or the feeding of the black hole doesn't last long enough so that the jet, you know, is unable to keep up its momentum long enough to get out, then you'll have a failed gamma ray burst, a choked gamma ray burst, but that will still produce neutrinos. So you could actually measure, if you measure these, you could actually measure the rate of these failed gamma ray bursts, and these actually may be much more numerous than the successful ones. At very high redshifts, we think that the first stars were very massive, and if very massive, you know, the jets may not have been able to get out. So perhaps, you know, there is this whole, you know, zoo of first generation stars there, which are only visible by these neutrinos. Of course, they will be visible also from their outer layers, but that will be thermal radiation, optical infrared, which is, you know, can be confused with other things.
What's the energy of these neutrinos?
These neutrinos are here, let me show you. This is a spectrum that we have calculated. There is both a PP portion here and a P gamma portion. So actually, you can get certainly here up to 10 to the 7 GeV, and then you have a component which gets on to up to about 10 to the 18.5 or so. The two curves below are that for the gamma ray bright burst, so those that we know are observed as bursts. So I've just put in numbers corresponding to the known gamma ray burst rate. The top two curves are assuming that there is 100 times more dark collapses. This is hypothetical, but it's not crazy. That's the number you would get if you assume that every supernova of type 2 in the universe, that number is known, leads to a black hole and a jet. That is the hypothesis. But, you know, the number corresponds to the number of supernova type 2 in the universe. So that could be an enormous flux, and of course it can exceed the cosmic ray band because those are, you know, proton dark. They're, you know, opaque sources. So, you know, it looks very optimistic, and probably the number is not nearly as high, but compared to the, you know, ice cube limits, it looks interesting, at any rate, to put constraints on these type of scenarios. Well, these are the signals of the very high redshift first generation population 3 stars. Again, let me just move on to other types of sources. Oh, that's assuming that the total energy in the collapse is 10 to the 54 ergs, so about the solar rest mass, or 10 to the 56, about 100 solar rest mass, assuming, you know, 100 solar rest mass of energy liberated in the black hole. That assumes, you know, you have a gigantic star of several hundred solar masses, leads to a black hole of 60 to 100 solar masses, you know, and you get, you know, a big boosted up type of gamma ray burst, but it would be a choked gamma ray burst again. Okay, let me pass over these quickly. These, you know, there is a type of, there is a sort of sub-school of the gamma ray burst collapsar model, and that is that you have a massive stellar collapse that leads to a black hole and the gamma ray burst. But suppose that the massive stellar collapse first leads to a neutron star, and therefore, and then it sort of waits a couple of weeks or months before the neutron star collapses to a black hole. So the initial collapse to a neutron star then produces a bounce, like in the usual supernova, so you get the shell ejected, and the shell has time to move out to 10 to the 15, 10 to the 16 centimeters. And then when several weeks or months later the gamma ray burst occurs because the neutron star collapsed to a black hole, let's say the neutron star was stabilized by rotation or something, you know, then you get your burst, and then you have out there this big shell, which is again a nice beam dump. So then you could make these kind of neutrino fluxes. Of course, these, again, hypothetical, but these would be a good way to test such hypotheses. There are some difficulties with these supernova model just from the stellar evolution scenario. The people doing simulations of stellar evolution don't quite manage to get these delays of weeks and months. Okay, well, these, let me skip over that. Some of these interesting implications of ultra-high energy neutrinos, you all know. You could test special relativity to a very high accuracy with very short bursts.
at least to 1 second or 10 to the minus 3 seconds. In short, there's the, you know, the simultaneity of equal arrival time or equal limiting arrival time of neutrinos and gamma rays. Of course, if neutrinos have mass, they won't have exactly the same speed, but limiting speed. And then time delays due to neutrino masses, you can test them to a very high accuracy. Vacuum oscillations, even though the mixing is caused by decoherence, you get a pretty high sensitivity. And of course, one more item is that if really, you know, you're accelerating protons, you can accelerate protons in these shocks up to, you know, GZK energies, in which case, really, you could be producing, you know, having interactions which are at 10 to the at PV energies in the center of mass. So you could be testing neutrino physics, or at least interaction cross sections up to that energy. All right, Ice Cube, I'm sure you all know about. Antares is the European version. It's under the Mediterranean Sea, so it's a bunch of phototubes in the Mediterranean in a much friendlier location. It will also have kilometer cube like Ice Cube, but its schedule is such that it's behind the curve in terms of timing. So it Ice Cube should get there before they do. They're in the planning stage, whereas Amanda is already built as a prototype, and you just build on Amanda. So excuse me if I don't talk about Ice Cube, but I'm sure other people will or have talked about Ice Cube. Sensitivity curves, you have seen that. Let me move on to AGNs, because time is running out. So the AGN cartoon is somewhat similar to what I showed, except that here you have, you know, an entire galaxy, so it's you know, 10 to the 11 solar masses, and processes, you know, stellar dynamic processes as well as a collapse leads to a massive black hole, 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8 solar masses at the center, and accretion can power a jet. The jets typically are more like Lorentz factors of 5 to 10, maybe 20, instead of 100 to 1,000 in the gamma ray bursts. And you have a source of photons, ultraviolet photons from the disk, and then there are cloud regions outside that produce the narrow line and the broad line absorption lines in quasars, which can scatter the UV and X-rays and scatter it back into the beam, into the jet. So you can have interactions of jet protons with a variety, either internal sources or external sources. But typically, you know, 98% of astrophysicists, they find that they can explain practically all the photon observations with just leptonic interactions, just electron, synchrotron, inverse Compton, and, you know, they don't need to invoke protons at all. Except that, you know, at the hairy edge of the 20 TeV photons there, there is some haggling as to, you know, whether do you really need, you know, hadrons for you know, photomeson interactions, etc. So here are some of the spectral energy distributions of photons from some AGNs. And you can see that typically they are two humped. And one hump is in the IR to X-ray, and then there is, you know, a second hump, which is X-ray to TV. And so in general, you can classify, these are typically blazars, so they're AGNs with jets which are pointing almost at the observer, so that the Doppler boost actually boosts the non-thermal radiation coming from the jet at the expense of the thermal radiation from the disk and the stars. So the continuum, non-thermal continuum, predominates. Here's an example of Markarian 501, which is a very hard one, where the you know, it reaches up to 20 TeV in flares. And this is one of the typical leptonic fits, the synchrotron external Compton type fits. And you can see, you know, the fits, I mean, as far as fits go, you can do a decent job. On the other hand, you can also do a fit when you assume that the only the lower hump is produced by normal leptonic synchrotron processes, but you consider that protons are accelerated in the same way as the electrons, you know something about how the electrons are accelerated because you see their spectrum. So you do the same thing for the protons, and then you find that the protons, they could be doing something interesting too. Initially, it was thought that the accelerated protons just would do a cascade, just interact with the synchrotron photons and produce, pions, muons, and all those cascades, and would do synchrotron radiation. Those simple, original hadronic models failed to reproduce the depression between the two humps. They produced a very featureless spectrum. But there is a new variant worked out mainly by Anita Mücke, where some of the radiation at high energies is attributed to proton synchrotron radiation, and then you have the rest of the cascade. And these so-called PSB, proton synchrotron blazar model, looks a lot better in terms of fits. Here the different components are these various, the several cascades simulated by Monte Carlo. And so a typical, the HBLs are the so-called the high blazars, the ones with the high, very high hum that goes to TeV. Those are simulations and data with the proton synchrotron blazar model. Down here is a simulation with the leptonic model. And so, with both of them, you can more or less do it. And so there is argument back and forth. The cosmic ray people, they prefer that one, and most astrophysicists prefer that one. And the truth lies somewhere in between.
How can you prevent protons from being accelerated?
You can't. But, that's the point. Well, the argument is that, what is the relative contribution of each? There is of course, if you do the you don't know much what is the ratio of the injection fraction of electrons and protons. You know that you should accelerate both, but if you say that I accelerate only 10% of those and 80% of those, that's one of those things that we don't know. So, if you reduce that contribution to a third, then that one will dominate, and so this is the haggling. So it's something that should be resolvable, but it needs more more speaking between the two schools of thought. Okay, now these are for the LBLs. Those are the low blazars, the ones where the low energy hump is at lower energies. But the thing is that the hadronic models, the proton models, should have a neutrino signature, and that neutrino signature, in principle. It has been claimed in the past that the neutrino signature would be absent in the leptonic models. Again, that is an exaggeration, but here's a typical neutrino signature for the synchrotron proton blazar model. And this is being touted as a smoking gun signature for the hadronic models of jets. And on the face of it, you might say, okay, but as you correctly mentioned, the leptonic models, they should accelerate protons as well. And if you assume that you accelerate as many protons as you accelerate electrons, then even the leptonic models will have a neutrino signature, albeit the neutrino signature should be somewhat different. So, I think it's in the working out of the details of the neutrino signature, the exact levels, but also the spectral shape, that one may be able to make some sense of these two different models, or to distinguish them. Well, I'm getting into time, am I?
Yeah, you have now
6 minutes. 6 minutes. Well, microquasars, there are predictions so far. I told you what they are. That's what they are. They're jets with relatively low speeds, but they should work more or less like the gamma ray burst models. And here are some of the predictions of the number of muons per kilometer squared that you might expect from some of these known microquasars, provided the jets are hadronic. It's unknown what the jets are made of, but if they're hadronic and the model parameters are more or less reasonable, you might get these kind of muons per kilometer squared fluence integrated over these amount of time mentioned there. These are days, that one is over a year. So this is a prediction, and these are galactic sources, so you know, the nearby sources, so otherwise optically and X-ray wise well studied. Supernova remnants are candidates for high energy hadronic radiation, and there are several that have been measured to produce TV radiation. Most of them can be explained with just electron, synchrotron, and inverse Compton. One of them, it's thought that is extreme enough that maybe there you need to invoke Pynot decay. It's the source here, RxJ17, whatever. In the others, the prediction for the neutrinos, well, in all of them, prediction for the muons per kilometer square in a year of observation, because these are study sources, would be what you see there in the last column. All right, it's thought that pulsar like systems might also do that, especially if they have an accretion disk. You accelerate protons and the protons then run into the disk. This model is, I'm just mentioning it, I think it has, it's a little bit difficult because you need to have a very low density up here so that the acceleration doesn't suffer, you know, you don't have too many radiative losses for the accelerated protons, but then you need a lot of density there, so you need a very clean environment in one direction and very dirty in another one. So it's a bit extreme. Normally, you have either one or the other in usual astrophysical systems. Okay, I'll just skip over the facilities here. Let me just mention briefly that in gamma ray bursts, you certainly can accelerate protons in the internal shocks up to energies which are GZK energy, so 10 to the 20 electron volt or a few times that. And the despite arguments one way or another, the cosmic ray energy input from, you know, the input into the you know, at Earth from all the gamma ray bursts is sufficient actually to explain that. There was some controversy. Berezinski and Stecker disputed the initial Waxman prediction, and Waxman a few months ago came out with a rebuttal showing that the numbers used now satisfy the thing. I think I've looked through that, and I think that we're okay. It is quite possible to explain the observations with the gamma ray bursts. That is not to say that the GZK observations, or, you know, 10 to the 20 electron volt cosmic rays, they may come from AGNs, because they can also do it. So we don't know, you know, whether one is more competitive than the other, but I think they both are on a comparable footing as far as plausibility and as far as energetics. All right, well, the rest is here just fluff. And Yuzo, Tom, you asked me to say something about Yuzo, but somebody must be saying something about Yuzo, right?
Yes.
Well, besides Auger, there is this plan for having, looking at, you all know about Auger, I'm sure. And so Yuzo is a plan for having on the International Space Station a large angle telescope which would observe observe fluorescence from very high energy cosmic rays above 5 times 10 to the 19 electron volts in the Earth's atmosphere, so observing a very large region. So here you would be getting, you know, maybe hundreds of GZK energy events per year. Now, initial plan was that operations might begin in 2008, 2009, but that was before the shuttle problem. So now it is, you know, up in the air. There will be at least delays of a year or two on that. Okay, so conclusions, I think they more or less you can guess from what I've been saying, but the measurement of ultra-energy neutrinos from AGNs and gamma ray bursts and other sources will certainly test the proton content of the jets, which at the moment is unconstrained. Because as I mentioned, you know, we could have MHD jets, zero protons, and you know, we could still explain most of the photon observations. But yet, you know, the astrophysics of producing a pure electron-positron MHD jet is very different from that of producing a proton-electron jet. So, you know, the whole astrophysical scenarios depend on, you know, they're different. So you could be probing that as well as acceleration physics, magnetic field contents in jets, etc. If you don't detect them, you have good constraints on both the scenarios and the shock physics and the acceleration, and then you have to start cooking up MHD models, which are more difficult to cook up, actually. You will be able to prove PV energies, neutrino interactions, test those various fundamental theories that I mentioned, and put interesting constraints on both stellar evolution and stellar death, stellar collapse, population 3 objects. And finally, as I was mentioning, you know, the new physics beyond the standard model, which is which fuels a lot of the interest in this very high energy arena, is certainly very important. But to motivate it and to sort of as a reality check, you have to sort of also know what it is you can produce with just, you know, more standard astrophysical scenarios within the standard model of particle physics. Unless you can do that, you will not be able to prove that what you have observed really is new physics. So you need, you know, I think you need to sort of certainly clear up this part of the two go hand in hand. You need to know both to you know, sort of set boundaries on each. Thanks.
If I can absorb the numbers, it looks like Ice Cube might see several dozen, several hundred neutrinos per year, but from a wide variety of sources. On an event-by-event basis, could you decide which kind of source is contributing?
Yeah, with the gamma ray bursts, you certainly would be able to tell that they're gamma ray bursts, because, you know, within the 0.7 degree angle of Ice Cube, you should have a burst occur there also within the time window. Even if it's a precursor, you know, it should be within 10 or 100 seconds. With the supernova remnants and the microquasars, again, you know the location, so you do that. Now with the buried jets and that kind of thing, so the sources are opaque. There you may really not have a positional or temporal coincidence, and there you may be, you know, you may have to fight it out against the atmospheric neutrino background and all that. So that will be hairier, unless the spectrum really sticks out, as it seems to stick out for some of these.
Yes? Is there a deuterium synthesis as a part of all cool?
Yes, there is certainly some deuterium synthesis, and that seems to eat up some of the neutrons. It's delicately dependent on the bulk Lorentz factor. So with the bulk Lorentz factors that we deduce from observations, it seems that, you know, you might sort of eat up maybe 10% or 15% of the neutrons, incorporate them into deuterium, but you don't... Well, I don't know what happens with the deuterium. I haven't. Maybe you do.
No, very well.
Yeah.
If we observe 10 to 20 PV protons here on Earth,
yes,
they come from gamma ray bursts, which are cosmological. Their energy must be much higher when they started.
Well, you wouldn't be observing them from cosmological distances, only from 50 or 100 megaparsecs, because you know, that's their interaction length with the cosmic microwave background. So within 50 or 100 megaparsecs, you have to assume, both with gamma ray bursts and with AGNs, you have to assume that since the rate within that volume is low per year, and we observe, you know, maybe, you know, one or two a year, you have to, you know, you have to assume that there is enough dispersion due to magnetic field that the rates then agree. And so so these would be nearby sources, so the energy is not a problem. What you have to explain is that you have enough dispersion, and that puts a limit on the magnetic field, which has to be... Not only that, but you need the time dispersion, okay, to spread it out. So you need limits on the magnetic field, that it has to be larger than 10 to the minus 10 Gauss. And that's within, you know, that satisfies current constraints. It's not crazy, although, you know, it's not otherwise very well motivable.
I have two questions, I guess. One is the map data suggests that these pop 3 stars were being made already in a Z of 10 or 20.
Yeah, 18 or so.
Increase or influence your neutrino prediction? And the other question is, we know there are cosmic ray protons at 10 to the 20 electron volts,
mm-hmm.
and they have to come from somewhere. So the people that don't want protons in their jets, what do they do with that data?
Well, they, you know, they ignore the cosmic rays. No, I mean I know. I mean you have to have, you know, the protons come from somewhere. I suppose those, you know, those people might argue for top down scenarios or whatever. But the sort of the simple assumption, you're quite correct, would be that, you know, you have protons in the jets and they do contribute to the cosmic rays. You know, that's a simple assumption. The alternative, the people who want to, you know, make MHD jets, pure electron positron jets, and forget about protons, they also forget about the cosmic rays. You know. So it's a somewhat, you know, it's a somewhat narrow attitude.
The pop 3 stars going back.
Yeah, the pop 3 stars, you would have to change those curves a little bit that I showed you for the pop 3 stars. Those were up to a redshift of 30, so, you know, you'd have to reduce the contributions a little bit. It would still be substantial.
I have a brief question.
Yeah.
Actually, the magnetic fields in the sheets where all these stars or stellar sources are could be much larger. The magnetic fields could be even 10 to the minus 6 kilometers.
Yeah.
So this would change some of the prediction for the protons.
Well, the... I think you could have higher fields in the collapsing pancakes where galaxies occur, but the, you know, simulations indicate that they could be as high, but there is no proof again that it is as high.
But this would change.
This would change it. Yeah. If you did that, if you had that kind of high fields, then you could explain all the cosmic rays, even with just M87, one very nearby, as Peter Biermann argues, with one very nearby AGN. But, you know, you really then have to have these. See, I mean, a microgauss is the magnetic field you have in our galactic disk, in our galaxy. And so to do that, you'd have to argue that the same field exists in intergalactic space, in our local... you know, in our local supergalactic environment, and I think, you know, it doesn't run into observations, but it's easier to test, and I think it's a little more extreme than it's a bit of a high risk type of prediction.
That's why it's interesting.
Yes.
Yeah. No more questions. Let us thank the speaker again.
Thanks.